G'day humans, welcome to the safe space of dangerous ideas, and this is a doozy of a dangerous conversation. I'm going to get a lot of hate for even talking to someone like this, because their stories aren't supposed to be heard. But I do think it's important just to hear the actual experiences of people who are collateral damage in our big, fancy, beautiful, fabulous culture wars. And in a week like this, when, if you live in Sydney, you're only just coming down from a 2 or 3 week extravaganza of pride in everything that the LGBTQIA plus community has achieved, there has been not a whisper of dissent from just the sheer relentless fabulousness of it all. The sequins, the feather boas, the waxed oiled chests and pectoral muscles of drag queens sitting astride gigantic inflatable penises. It's been marvelous, I gotta tell you. And I kicked the whole extravaganza off on ABC, the national broadcaster, 3 weekends ago at Fair Day, which is the family-friendly LGBTQIA plus event. Come one, come all, grandma and the kids, hear about how fantastic it is to be trans. I interviewed several trans people on the air live, and they were fabulous people, and God bless them. And I have since hung out with several of my trans friends. Some of those people are binary. Some of those people are non-binary. I'm very much, I think I've earned my bona fides in the trans space in terms of making it clear that I have absolutely no problem with transgender people. I did an entire segment, an entire episode rather, about J.K. Rowling, which copped me shit from both sides, but I made it absolutely clear that trans people are real and exist and deserve to transition and deserve all of our support and no prejudice or bigotry or discrimination. And at the same time, because I am a person who likes to deal in nuance and detail instead of arm-waving hysteria, it is possible that in our zeal to make life better for traditionally shat upon communities, that's the technical term if you're an anthropologist, a traditionally shat upon community, of which I am a member. I mean, I'm married to a guy. My grandparents survived the Holocaust. You know, I've got the Jew card. I've got the gay card. I got a number of cards, you know, and I'm working on the disability card maybe, you know, if I could figure out a way to lose a leg. Anyway, that won't let you in on too much of my future plans. They'll call me Hopalong Zeps. I think I've had my bona fides in supporting people who have been traditionally shat upon. And nonetheless, it just irks me when there's an insistence that there is no problem when a problem may exist. So then I go sniffing around to see whether or not it's true that there is no problem. And the no problem that my community insists does not exist is an over-identification of transness, perhaps a haste on the part of the medical profession to validate the trans identity of young people who may simply be confused about their gender or sexuality, who may have internalized homophobia and they may be lesbians. A disproportionate number of them are on the autism spectrum. The possibility that in our enthusiasm for affirming the lived experience of gender dysphoric people, we may also be catching up in our net of sparkles and glitter a certain proportion of people who really don't belong on the train to transition. And Casey Miller is one of them. Casey's a female to male and now back to female detransitioner who is speaking out about the pediatric transition situation. And Casey asked their followers on Twitter who the followers would like them to talk to, and my name popped up. Casey first came to my attention in a viral video that they posted in last October. And I noticed it. It's a video of Casey sitting in a car, staring straight at the camera and sharing some of their experiences. What you see is a youngish, fresh-faced, what looks like a young man with male pattern baldness. And this is how the video goes.
So I got out of my haircut because my hair was driving me nuts. And I shaved it because I'm tired of watching my hair thin out, and it's less distressing if I shave it. So when I talk about being too far gone, I don't really know what else to call it. This is what I mean. This is how deep my voice is. it's gotten deeper over time, and it's settled. This is what I mean by hair loss. And it just keeps getting worse. It keeps thinning. It keeps receding backwards. And I'm not exactly sure that's coming back. Those are the main things when I talk about being androgenized to a point of no return. I really don't see those being fixable. So that's when I talk about, just kind of staying how I am, regardless of how I feel. That's why, just because I don't really see me personally being able to come back from what's happened so far. So I hope that's a little explanatory, just to kind of give a little bit more of a, talk about, give more awareness to the situation, so you can see where I'm at. Words are not working well with me right now. I'm just gonna cut this off. There you go. This is what happens when you give a woman testosterone. This for 5 years. This is what happens, essentially. So, that's it. Stay safe.
So that's the first time I saw Casey, and when I got an email from them, I was confronted with a little bit of a conundrum of journalistic integrity, right? Many people who have the loudest voices on this issue say, and I have some sympathy for this view, that we shouldn't do interviews like this one, because to do so is to sort of play into the hands of transphobic conservatives who want to undermine justice for trans people altogether by shining a spotlight on a vanishingly rare number of cases who should never have transitioned in the first place. And I get that. And I get that that dynamic is happening and that there are bad actors on the right. Matt Walsh in America, Tucker Carlson, people who have never had the interest of trans people or just of general human flourishing, frankly, in mind. And who will cherry pick and present and amplify all of the flaws of the trans community. And every single little case where someone has been misled in order to try to present that as being the norm and inflate the scale of the crisis. When Matt Walsh was on Joe Rogan's podcast, he overestimated the number of transgender procedures and detransitioners by something like 1,000-fold or 10,000-fold. I mean, the man has spent so long, he's an anti-trans activist, that has spent so long focusing on this crisis. The only people he speaks to are the people who have had problems in this area and who have detransitioned. Those are the only people who reach out to him. That he has a completely skewed vision of the landscape, of what's actually going on. But I don't think I do. I mean, these are my friends. These are my people. This is my community. I'm a journalist. It's also largely my beat. I don't think I'm a voice who spends a lot of time banging on about how we have to save the children from the transgender ideology that's coming to get them. Most people who come out as trans are trans and need to be trans and will be happier being trans, and that's fine. All credit to them. But I'm not going to throw under the bus a cohort of people who either have mental health issues or are finding it difficult to come out as gay or lesbian or queer or bi or are on the spectrum or are social outcasts or excluded or are having behavioral issues or having problems at home, I'm not going to throw those people who are having issues around gender under the bus by saying, okay, in the interests of transgender acceptance, you're going to have to get on top of this train and we're going to start shoving pills in your mouth and performing surgery on you, because that's the only way to be happy once you start thinking that you're born into the wrong sex, the wrong body. I mean, that just strikes me as a horrendous Faustian pact, an awful moral trade-off. And if you're finding yourself thinking, Josh, stop being such a nuance bro, like, that is not what's happening. Of course, if that was on the other side of the ledger, then we would need to hear more stories about it. But nobody is having pills shoved down their throat and experimental surgeries performed on them. This is nonsense. It's not happening. Well, maybe that's why you have to receive more emails from the Casey Millers of the world. And maybe that's why you have to follow your journalistic instinct or your instinct for actually understanding issues and just talk to them about what happened to them. This episode is in no way intended to imply that Casey's case is the majority of cases or is even a significant minority of cases. The reality is we don't know. There's no good data on this. It's only an N of one. But it is a real human life. And Casey's story deserves to be told just as much as the people with sequins and feather boas and beautiful waxed oiled pectoral muscles deserve to be told. Enjoy this conversation with Casey Miller.
So I have been in outpatient mental health treatment because obviously coming to the realization that decisions that you made as a 16-year-old to physically transition to the opposite sex and why you came to those conclusions, that can definitely have a big mental toll on you. I was definitely in my feels a lot. I knew I needed to seek help, and I sought help, and I spent several weeks in an intensive outpatient program, which I found extremely beneficial for me. And now I'm in outpatient behavioral health. So that's been preoccupying a lot.
What does that mean, Casey? How long how many hours a week does that occupy?
So there's different levels in the United States. There's intensive outpatient adult day program. Adult day program is 7 hours of group therapy a day, 5 days a week. And intensive outpatient is 4 hours of group therapy a day, 3 days a week.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. It is a lot. It's very tiring.
Tiring and also expensive. How is that funded even?
Actually, my insurance is really good about covering mental health related things. So my copay was very small.
Amazing.
For all of that. I think it was like $5 a day, $5 US a day.
See, this is what a lot of people don't understand in America when they're like, oh, we should have universal healthcare like other countries do, like Canada and Australia. I mean, there's no way that anything like that would be funded. Like, if you have good insurance in America, then actually when I was living there, I found that the health insurance system, whilst frustrating and like difficult to deal with, and it's annoying to have to deal with like HIPAA and all these crazy forms and like who takes what insurance and stuff, once you're actually in the system getting it, it covers so much more than any place that has socialized medicine does. So that's good that you're getting the care. And how do you spend the rest of your time? Do you study? Do you have a job? What do you do?
So I didn't have a job. I tried to go back to work. So on top of the whole transition stuff and some other mental health issues, I have some physical conditions as well, which I thought I had put in remission. So I was originally in nursing school. I was going to be a nurse, cool. Get my associate's degree, and that was in 2021 to 2022, but I developed POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, starting in the fall of 2021 and throughout the spring of 2022. It's heart and nervous system. So essentially my vasculature just doesn't work correctly. So it stays consistently vasodilated, and because of that, my heart has to work overtime just to circulate the same amount of blood and to oxygenate everything. It's a very gross oversimplification, but the result is increased heart rate.
We're allowed to oversimplifications work for me.
Increased heart rate, lightheadedness, and just kind of some complications with that. Chronic fatigue, that's another really big one. We also discovered that I have EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder, and that was causing a lot of chronic pain. Long and short, I went from being a somewhat fully functional young adult to not being able to lift 40 pounds, not being able to stand up for 20 minutes without feeling like I want to pass out. So I had to medically drop out of nursing school. So that was kind of a kick in the pants, and I've been trying to figure out what to do. I was thinking about social work. I was thinking about psychology, but now I am looking to return to school for biochem.
Great. How old are you?
I'm 22.
And did any of these health problems predate your transition? Like, what is your opinion about the, is there a causation there, or would these things have happened anyway?
So interestingly enough, I think the POTS was more stress related. Looking back, I think I had symptoms of it in times of stress as an adolescent, but it wasn't an issue at all until like the high stress period in nursing school, which there was just a bunch of stuff going on mentally. And that was also, looking back, the first time that I was even contemplating the idea of transition regret. I would make jokes like, oh, it'd be really crappy if I regretted this because, like, look at me, like, but I don't regret this. And kind of thinking through that in my head, but really just pushing it back while also dealing with basically drinking, like, through a fire hose and getting all this information about, like, clinical nursing practice and medications and conditions and knowing that if you screw up, you could kill somebody and all of that stuff all at the same time. Mm.
Let's just go back to your teens then, because I remember seeing that video that you posted just in passing, as the, you know, the way that one sees anything that goes viral and has a moment, and I thought it was very touching. And to take us back to a few years before that, I guess, and at what point in your adolescence, like when you went through puberty as a female, how did you feel about yourself?
So I had a lot of conflicting feelings about myself and my body. But looking back, I think a lot of that was just normal female insecurity. But because of the environment that I was raised in, and also having a background of sexual abuse as a child, we didn't really talk about body image issues or how common that was. So I thought this was just a completely isolated issue. I was a pretty sheltered kid as well. So I just thought that, like, everybody else was fine with their body and I was having issues with my body, and only I was having issues with my body. I didn't realize that virtually every other teenage girl is going to have issues when they hit puberty. They're not going to like their periods, and they're not going to, you know, like how their body develops in certain ways, or have issues with weight, or, you know, how their body looks in clothes and how boys look at them. I didn't realize that that was a universal issue just because that was something that was never talked about.
Mm. Did you have crushes on boys or girls?
I think I somewhat had crushes on boys, but they weren't really as deep as with girls. I was mostly attracted to girls, which, for a little bit of background, I grew up fundamentalist Christian, and church was not very happy about anything homosexual. I was not out in the church. They thought I was just like a straight little poster child, but in terms of the messaging that I had received from an early age about homosexuality, same-sex attraction, being gay, as far as I knew, it was a choice. You were a predator. You were disgusting. You were an abomination.
Right. And where are you? Where did you grow up, Casey?
So I was born in Massachusetts, and then when I was 8, we moved to Pennsylvania, where I've lived since.
Rural Pennsylvania?
The area that I'm in, not to give myself away too much, it's kind of a weird mix of rural and suburban. Mm. So it's interesting.
I only ask because for people who don't know the United States, Pennsylvania is a very odd state in that it's kind of half like the Deep South and half like progressive cities. So it makes
it's really weird. That's why, like, when trying to describe it, I say like it's generally red with really blue pockets ideologically. I mean, it's weird because like the town that I live near, we have like a major medical center, we have a research university, a medical school. That area is pretty liberal, pretty accepting. But then if you go 20 minutes outside of town, it's the opposite. You're in very conservative backcountry. Mm. It's an interesting dichotomy.
And were you questioning your faith when you were in your teens, or did you basically swallow it hook, line, and sinker?
I have a propensity to question everything, much to the dismay of my teachers, my preachers, everybody, even my science teachers. They would get so annoyed because they would state something and I'd be like, well, why? And they're like, stop asking why. I would always ask questions, but I bought into it pretty heavily.
Like great teachers. That's a great great spirit of academia to instill. Stop asking questions.
Okay, well, how did we come to that conclusion? Okay, we came to that conclusion 20 years ago. What's the data say about it now? And oh, my bio teacher hated me because I would always ask so many questions. Anyways, I did ask questions, but generally speaking, I bought into it pretty hard because it was just what I had grown up with. It was what I knew.
Sure. And you mentioned sexual assault when you were younger. What was that? I mean, you don't need to talk about it any more than you're comfortable with, but.
Oh, no, it's fine. I'm relatively an open book with a lot of these things. So I was sexually abused by my father from, the estimate is about age 4.5 to 7.5, at which time I revealed the abuse. I was removed from the home by my mom. And investigation began by Massachusetts State Police. The 4.5 to 7.5 is an estimation based on forensic psychology reports in terms of me being interviewed when I was like 7.5. So for all we know, it could have been happening sooner.
Mm. Horrendous. So, I'm sorry. And was that properly dealt with by the authorities? Was he charged?
Yes, he was charged. He's currently incarcerated in prison on the sex offender list. They gave him the max sentence that they could.
What was your relationship with your mom like during all that?
It's interesting because I don't remember too much about that time. The only things that I remember, I was a pretty happy-go-lucky kid, and our relationship was okay, but that was where I kind of saw the shift from her being a mom to her being a caregiver. She's also a nurse, has worked in nurse management, quality control and risk management and all of that stuff, and has worked previously as a pediatric nurse. And when I started really displaying symptoms of depression and anxiety, or particularly panic attacks, which happened shortly after we left the home, that's when she kind of kicked into nurse mode and started to, you know, de-escalate, manage the situation. And that's where the relationship started to change. To the point where over the years I can look and, you know, she's been my mom at certain times, but other times I can absolutely see where she shifts into like caregiver mode, caretaker mode. And I've kind of turned into not just her child, but her patient.
And so how did you feel about that?
I didn't realize it was happening until recently, of course, kind of looking back on the dynamics and so on. I understand that was what we needed to do to survive and that she was just trying to keep me stable. And certainly there's been certain things that we've said to each other, certain things that she's done, certain things I've described to therapists that they have said is definitely classified as emotional abuse. She's definitely not completely innocent in my upbringing, but at the same time, when we talk about it today, she goes, I understand and I'm sorry, but I was just trying to keep you alive because ever since I was age 9, I was expressing suicidal ideation. So she was just trying to keep me from really falling off the edge. And I mean, that's all I could ask for when you're just trying to manage a child in and out of crisis as a single mom.
Yeah. Did you find her cold, though, at the time when she was in nurse mode?
Oh, absolutely. And I didn't understand this until I went through part of nursing school myself, because you kind of just flip into a mode. You can't just panic. You start running through the algorithms that you have in your head. All right, I'm going to start assessing. I'm going to start evaluating the situation. you know, what needs to be done, what needs to be managed, how do we de-escalate the situation, what do we need to do to move forward, in terms of not being able to turn that off. Because I would jokingly say, like, I'm your kid, I'm not your patient, like, treat me like your kid. And she's like, I'm a nurse, I can't turn it off. And
right.
Then I experienced the not being able to turn it off thing, though. A year on from it, I can turn assessment mode off, but that's because I'm not submerged in it.
And you mentioned suicidal ideation. How young were you when you first started thinking those sorts of thoughts?
So I was 9. I recall first time I started thinking about or confronting death and thinking about death was when my grandma died. So she had breast cancer and she passed, trying to think, it was July of 2009. Sorry. So I was still 8. So she passed in July of 2009. And this was in the midst of moving from Massachusetts to Pennsylvania and switching schools. And it was just like a really rough and tumultuous time, and understanding that something had gone horribly wrong. I had no idea what sex was or what sexual abuse was. I just knew that something really bad had happened to me, and that all of a sudden my dad was very dangerous, and that we had to run away, and that there was a threat to our safety. And I had feelings about this because I was starting to blame myself, because I always thought that based on the conditioning, that anything that had happened, I don't know, I started to blame myself for the abuse, because of the way that my dad had reinforced basically anything going wrong in his life was my fault, and he would pin it on me and my mom. And when I found that my grandma had died and I had seen this person that was once living and now she's dead, that was the first time that I confronted mortality. And I, you know, thinking, well, everybody's going to end up like that one day. Why can't I end up like that now? I don't like what I'm feeling. You know, and it was the first time that it's weird because I didn't think, oh, I could just go kill myself. But it was the first time that I confronted death and thought, well, why can't that be me?
Mm. You poor little thing. I just want to go back in time and give you a hug.
Yeah, it's hard because, like, I can say all of this stuff and I try and refrain from cracking jokes at my own expense. To me, this is just my life. This is just what I live with. It's pretty baseline for me. And then I realize how screwed up some of it is.
Yeah.
Whenever I just talk to anybody else.
An 8-year-old and a 9-year-old should not have to have gone through that. I mean, you lived an entire life of trauma before the age of 8, and to then be in such a situation that your crazy little brain thinks that the solution is that it has to extinguish itself because, like, it's to blame for all of the shit that has been thrown at it is tragic. It's horrible. I'm sorry that all of that happened. But as you say, what do you do except you do the work and you move on and you dust yourself down and you get off? And I'm glad that you've done that. So anyway, you enter your teens. We hear about you going through puberty. You start to have crushes on girls. That mm-hmm. doesn't mesh with your faith. What happens next? How do you start thinking about your own identity?
So for a little bit of reference, I also have a condition called PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. So I am generally a larger female. I'm 5'8". I have a larger frame. And I always had trouble fitting in girls' clothes. I also had some weight issues, but mostly it was I ran into issues with clothes and things like the shoulders. Like I would always rip shirts because they were it was always too small and too narrow in the shoulders. Mm-hmm. I had to mostly shop in the men's section by the time I reached high school for shoes, because I was a size 12 wide women's, and you try going into a shoe store and buying a size 12 wide women's off the shelf. It's just not going to happen. And that just kind of fit with, what I was more comfortable with. I had a preference towards, I guess, what you would say male stereotypical activities. I was a tomboy. I was always a tomboy.
Yeah.
And especially when you're dealing with body image issues and you're slightly bigger than your female peers, and you know, you're kind of thinking about trying to lose weight and trying, and it's not succeeding, and you don't know how to really approach food correctly because neither my mom or I really had a healthy relationship with food. You start to try and look for ways to hide the issue. So a lot of my clothes were on the baggier side. I tended more towards androgyny, just out of personal preference, but also because it would hide my size a little bit.
And it's difficult because I didn't view myself like other girls because my body didn't necessarily look like theirs, but I think it was also just making it a bigger problem than it actually was.
Right. Yes, as teenagers do.
Yeah. So that combined with, like, because of the church that I was in, they loved that I was modest because I was very modest. I didn't, you know, because of the androgyny and so on, I always wore button-down shirts. My thing was plaid button-down shirts and jeans. That was kind of my standard outfit. It was very modest and they liked that, but they didn't like the fact that it wasn't so overtly feminine. And at all the other girls in youth group, they were pretty stereotypically feminine, and were also very vocal about having crushes on boys, but oh, don't worry, we're abstinent. And I was the only one that wasn't, and that was kind of questioned. And also hearing like the prevailing stuff in youth group, like lessons specifically on homosexuality in teens, and that it's a choice, it's a fad, it's a phase, it's just going to pass, and all of that stuff. And then on the adult side, hearing like the adult sermons on homosexuality, that, you know, homosexuals are predators and that they're trying to, I guess, seduce straight people. And they're just these horrible people, and that it's all a choice, and that it's, you know, sin of the flesh, and all these horrible things. And internalizing that, hearing, well, you know, gay people are predators, and knowing that my dad was a predator, I started to feel like a predator for being attracted to girls and trying so desperately hard to change that. And it just, it wasn't changing. So and grappling with that.
Casey, did you say that you weren't abstinent and the other girls were?
Oh, sorry, no. We were all abstinent. They all talked about having crushes on boys, and I never did.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay. And so where did you first come up with the idea or encounter the idea that people could be born in the wrong sex, in the body of the wrong sex?
Oh, boy. I remember this so vividly. It was April, May of 2017, and for a little bit of reference, I had a relationship in the previous year. I was a junior in high school. I had a relationship with a girl, and my mom found out, and I was just in a mentally dark place, and I got really suicidal.
Non-Americans, a junior is your second last year?
Yes.
Is that right? Year 11, we would probably call it?
Yeah, year 11.
Yeah.
And I was in a really dark place. My mom found out. She flipped, and I got really suicidal. I was a risk to myself, admitted myself inpatient over Christmas break 2016 going into 2017. And this entire time I was really grappling with, you know, hating the fact that I was gay, hating the fact I began to tell myself I wish I wasn't a woman, because then I could like women. If I was a man and I liked women, I would be straight and no one would bother me. Just having this intense self-hatred around my sex, based on my sexuality and based on the homophobia that I had experienced, and also my mom just really not liking that I was gay. That was a really big issue. And of course, when you type into Google, I'm a woman and I don't want to be a woman, what do I do? Eventually, that's going to lead to transgender stuff. And the first video that I remember seeing that showed me that physical transition, medical transition was an actual thing and that it was possible was a New York Times op-ed on the military transgender couple Logan and Leila Ireland. I don't know if you've seen that or heard of them.
No, I haven't.
But Logan Ireland was, I don't know if he's currently in still, was a transgender service member in the United States Air Force. He kind of presented more as like a butch lesbian or stereotypically masculine woman, short hair, liked women, and then transitioned to male. But when you see the guy, there's this joke in gender critical circles that, oh, you can always tell when somebody's trans. You couldn't tell with that guy. And I was absolutely blown away to find out that he was born a woman. The guy's jacked. He was probably the most jacked person on his unit because it showed him in comparison with the other guys. Huge biceps, big muscles. You couldn't see his top surgery scars. And like, it was the first time that I had even seen that like you could start as a woman and in my mind end up looking like a man and a very muscular man. And I thought no one would mess with me if I looked like that. Mm. And that's just where it, you know, it just fell down the rabbit hole for me.
What did that look like? Like what
eventually from there, because the other half of that was Layla Ireland, who is a male to female transgender individual. And in my opinion, you also couldn't tell with her that she was biologically male. But for me, obviously, the female to male aspect was a little bit more intriguing and applicable. So that triggered me to look into female to male YouTubers. And I found a lot of these channels of trans men who dedicate all of their videos to their transition. And especially some of the younger ones, there are trans guys 16, 17, 18 years old. And that's where I saw video after video after video of people, you know, posting 1 year on testosterone, post-op top surgery, and talking about their transformations and how their life went from unlivable, unbearable to now they're these happy, outgoing, confident people. And they feel like they're finally who they're meant to be and that, you know, people respect them now and that they just fit into society better. And that they could, you know, wear men's clothes and do men's things and, you know, everything was all hunky dory. It was fine. And I started to think that maybe that was something that I wanted too.
So what did you do?
From there, I think from there, then I started to kind of buy into the idea of if you meet the sex stereotypes of the opposite sex and you have this desire to not be your current sex, then that must mean that you should be the opposite sex and you should transition and that that's your identity, that's immutable, and that this needs to happen. And around May, June, I quote unquote came out to my mom as trans. At first it was non-binary because I kind of just wanted to be gender neutral androgynous, but that was not going to work. She said, well, that's not a real thing. I'm not going to take you seriously. So I was like, oh, screw it. I'll just go for broke. And I said, well, I'm meant to be a dude. And at first she was very adverse and was like, this sounds weird. This sounds like something you just found on the internet, which it was. But then eventually she kind of took a step back and was like, hold on, let me do some research, let me do some digging. And she'd found that there was actually clinical research going on about trans and specifically gender-affirming care in youth, and saw that the regret rate, the infamous detransition rate is less than 2%, and saw that there are major children's hospitals offering gender clinics and that we're also doing research. And she thought, okay, you know, this is what my child is saying. My child is not stupid. You know, the internet's the internet, but my child is not stupid. And I don't think they'd be making this up. I'm not an expert. Nobody around here is an expert. Let's go to experts to try and figure this out.
Mm. When you just mentioned in passing the infamous detransition rate of 2%, what do you mean by that?
So there is this prevailing idea that is peddled in the transgender community that detransition is non-existent, nobody detransitions, or it is a statistically irrelevant amount of people that detransition. Some people say it's a less than 2% detransition rate, or in some, there's one study I think that said that they had a 0.3% detransition rate. And by detransition, they mean returning to live as your birth sex, and or stopping medical interventions, whether that's hormone therapy or other medical interventions that somebody might undergo to physically transition. But then they also say, well, in that 2%, the majority of those people that do detransition do so because of transphobia, not being able to afford hormones. It's not because they actually regretted it. It's not because it was the wrong decision. It's because the world is making it hard for them to live as quote unquote who they really are. And that statistic was something that my mom ran into. That was something that eventually when we did go to a gender clinic, she was told by the clinician that evaluated me that this is a, you know, very, very low regret rate, very low detransition rate, that this was it was used to defend this as a correct decision.
Right. In fact, there was a big study that got some press, I think about a year ago out of was it the Netherlands or Denmark, which had looked at detransitioning and had and was being presented in, there were a lot of articles in the US press, which is where I found out about this, saying that this proves that detransition rates are negligible, you know, somewhere in the 2% range or something. And then Jesse Singel, who is like a dog on a bone with trying to dig into this stuff, a journalist who has done probably more research into all these this data than anybody else, actually contacted the person, spoke to the researcher themselves to clarify this. And the cohort of people whom the researcher had taken in this study were people who currently self-identify as transgender. In other words, of the cohort of people who currently self-identify as transgender, a very small fraction of them detransitioned. But the researcher was saying, you would expect that to be the case because people who have successfully detransitioned no longer self-identify as transgender because they've transitioned. And that was a point that was either elided or confused by all of the American press reports. So that was yet another kind of line in the sand of people saying, see, almost nobody detransitions, but you're sort of tautologically excluding anybody who would have successfully detransitioned from the cohort of people who you're analyzing. So anyway, you're just saying take those statistics with a grain of salt. But your mum wasn't in a position to take them with a grain of salt because she was going to experts, and experts were saying this is almost certainly not going to happen. So what happens next? Do you have a psychological evaluation?
Yes. So there's also this other myth that it is extremely difficult to get into gender clinics, especially pediatric gender clinics, that the whole process take months and months and years, and that there's a super thorough evaluation. Obviously, things could have changed between now and then, but I'm willing to bet that things have probably gotten easier than when I went through it, especially with the change from Standards of Care 7 to Standards of Care 8. In terms of a lot of those safeguards, especially on the pediatric and adolescent side, that were lifted. But for me, we self-referred through the internet. My mom sent an email to Children's Hospital Philadelphia's Gender and Sexuality Development Program in July of 2017. I had my first appointment in September. It was 90 minutes. I had my second appointment in October, also 90 minutes. And after that appointment, I was referred to a local clinic for testosterone, and I started in December. And then 6 months later, I had a double mastectomy. So looking back on it, that's a pretty fast process.
One thing that non-Americans might find weird about the American healthcare system is that because care is not rationed through the public purse, there's no gatekeeper between the consumer and the specialist. So in countries with public health, with socialized medicine, to use the controversial term, you would always need a general practitioner, a family doctor, to be the gatekeeper in order to even see a specialist. And that doctor would be the person who funnels you either towards the gender clinic or towards further psychiatric follow-up. In the United States, because your private health insurance is paying for things, you can just go directly to specialists and you don't need any gatekeeper. Do you have any idea about whether or not that changes the dynamic outside of the States? Have you spoken with anyone outside the States about what their experience was?
I have spoken to people outside of the States, but not specifically about how socialized healthcare systems impact their access to just healthcare in general or gender-affirming care. I will say, at least in my area, there are certain specialties that you still need to get a referral through primary care or your GP in order to get into the office. Like, you can't just call the office as a new patient and get an appointment.
But that's not the case for a sexual health clinic or a trans.
Correct. You can refer from the internet. That's one of those. I think in behavioral health as well, because recently, even with the adult day hospital, I was able to self-refer.
Interesting. Yeah, okay. So you show up, you are a survivor of sexual abuse. You have this mom who's in nurse mode treating your chronic illnesses. You've had a death in the family. You've moved states. You've admitted yourself to an inpatient psychiatric clinic already, and they take two 90-minute sessions to conclude that none of that is relevant to your current claim to be trans.
Correct.
Did they talk to you about that stuff?
From what I can recall, And I don't remember too much about the conversations, but I do remember that Dr. Hawkins had stated at one point, I forget whether it was in the, I think it was in the second session. Yeah, it was in the second session, because I remember the locations. I remember what the rooms looked like. I don't remember a ton of what was said specifically, but she said, to the extent of which the impact of the abuse was investigated with me, she said something along the lines of, now, I know that you have a painful childhood history. We're not going to get into it. And we'll only talk about stuff as far as you're comfortable. But do you think that this is impacting how you feel? And of course, I had already had this conversation with my mom, who was telling me, like, you have literally told me prior to finding transgender stuff on the internet, if I was a boy, the abuse wouldn't have happened. And she was like, I'm pretty sure your father, this is kind of callous, this is a little bit screwed up, but she was like, I'm pretty sure your father would have abused you anyways, whether you were a boy or a girl, that was just who he was. Thanks, Mom, that's really reassuring. But I had already voiced this, you know, kind of hatred for myself as female before I even knew what trans was. And then finding trans and thinking, you know, I have all this body insecurity and all of that stuff. And she had voiced several times to myself and Dr. Hawkins that she suspected this was a response to the childhood abuse, and that this was just a coping mechanism for me. And literally the only, to the extent it was investigated with me, was, do you think this is related to the abuse? And I said no. And that's as far as it went with me.
I mean, it's ludicrous to ask the patient. Of course, if you're a young person who thinks that they've found the Holy Grail that's going to provide a solution to all of their problems, simply saying, are you doing this out foolishly because you think it's going to solve your problems, seems like malpractice. It's like saying to someone, do you think that this reaction is just psychosomatic and doesn't actually have anything to do with, you know, what's really going on? I mean, if the whole nature of something being psychosomatic or someone being mistaken about themselves is that they can't see that they were mistaken. If they could see that they were mistaken, then they wouldn't be sitting in front of you. Anyway, so that's the extent of the interrogation as you recall it. And then once you start on testosterone 2 months and two sessions after first encountering the clinic, what happens? How do you start feeling?
So I responded pretty quickly to testosterone, and on my original Twitter account, which I have since deactivated just because of how I had gained all the notoriety and the attention. I have a new one though, and I'm starting to make waves there. But on there, I had talked about how I had started, my voice began to drop within 2 weeks of starting testosterone on a very low dose. And I had people responding me, telling me that was not humanly possible. But it happened. I responded fairly quickly. Within 3 months, my voice had dropped noticeably. And within 6 months, it was unrecognizable. And I was also starting to work out in the gym. And I was not super strong. I mean, I was never super strong, but like I was starting to work out and I was seeing the newbie gains. And then you just slap testosterone on top of that. My numbers were going up and I, you know, was pretty happy. And my body was changing in ways that I thought I wanted, and in ways that I had thought that I needed. And that was very exciting. And it was,
what sort of ways? What were you noticing the most?
Mainly the voice, some body recomposition. The voice was the main thing to drop, though, and strength.
Yeah, strength. Did you feel different? I mean, like, not physically, but was there any emotional component other than the fact that you liked the fact that this was a process that you were undertaking? Did you find yourself either easier to anger or less creative, or I don't know, anything else you noticed?
I didn't notice a psychological impact of hormones directly until I probably reached full dose. I'm very fortunate, and I felt this way even when I was, you know, still deeply trans-identifying. I'm very fortunate that I went to a provider that didn't just put me on full-dose testosterone right away. They at least had a little bit of common sense and thought, okay, we're going to start at a really small dose and taper up in small increments and assess tolerance and see how this is going to go, instead of just, because there's some people, even like there were some YouTubers that I followed that they went in and they start on 100 milligrams of testosterone weekly right away. Mm. And it really can screw people up. I mean, it could screw people up anyways, but it can really mess with somebody if you just blast them with testosterone out of the blue.
Okay, so it takes 6 months, you said, to from between starting on testosterone and then going into surgery. When do you first meet the surgeon? How does that process get underway?
So I started testosterone in late December of 2017, and by March, April, CHOP was back in contact with me, and they were like, how's testosterone going? Are we still feeling like top surgery is the next objective? Cool, we'll get you in touch with the surgeon. And so I had my appointment in April, and like that was just kind of an assessment consultation, and we were able to schedule for mid-June pretty easily.
What was the conversation about? Risks, rewards, reversibility?
Honestly, I don't remember much about risks being talked about. Mostly it was about methods. So in top surgery, I'm not sure if you're, I will try not to get too graphic here, but there are different kinds of top surgery or double mastectomies that are performed in female to male transitional surgery. So there is the most typical one, which is double incision with nipple grafts, which more closely resembles what a double mastectomy would look like for a female cancer patient. And that's the one where you see like the two big scars, and then like the nipples are basically taken off of the breasts and like grafted back on in a male position. But then there's another procedure called periareolar, or there's also another one called keyhole, where essentially if there's a small enough amount of breast tissue, they can kind of just make little incisions near the nipples and go in and remove the tissue out and sew it back up. They don't have to make these two big incisions.
Right. Is that kind of like liposuction?
Yes. Actually, the procedure itself is very similar to if men get surgery to remove gynecomastia.
What's gynecomastia?
Gynecomastia is enlarged breast growth in men.
Okay.
Which could be due to hormonal fluctuations, maybe Klinefelter syndrome. Could also be because of weight issues, okay, depending on the circles that you run in, steroid abuse.
Without big scars. And so you were basically given the option of these?
I was told what he was going to do. He went with the periareolar approach because he felt he could get away with it, because I was like a size B. He's like a big size A, small size B. And he said, you know, I don't think I need to make the big incisions. I think I can just go in with small incisions underneath, and, you know, kind of scoop things out. You'll have drains for a week. Should be fine. Low complication rate.
Okay. So you went with that?
Mm-hmm.
How'd it go?
I mean, it was a pretty easy process for me. I didn't really have any major complications. I had to manage the drains. So when you have this procedure done, you get like I forget what they're called, but JP drains that are put inside the chest wall, and they kind of poke out the sides, like right below your armpits. And you have to manage those for a week post-op while you wear either like a post-surgical binder or like this sticky dressing that goes across your chest. And I was kind of squeamish at the time. But you have to measure and empty the drains every day and measure the fluid and keep track of it. And that was an interesting task. I would say that was probably the most quote unquote traumatic part of it, and getting the drains pulled, because they said, oh, it's going to be a painless process. But I didn't take any painkillers before having that done. And then I got them pulled, and that was an interesting time. Not painless. They were like, oh, it's painless if you're on Percocet. And I'm like, oh, I didn't take any Percocet.
Do you have any Percocet? Okay. And what's your mom's attitude towards all this, towards the pace of your diagnosis and then onto the drugs and then onto the mastectomy?
she was under the influence. At first, she was very hesitant. She made it clear, and I saw this looking back at the medical records, which I obtained last year, that she wanted to be supportive of me, but she was very cautious around permanent changes because they're permanent. And she also had her theories, her two theories that I was doing this because of sexual abuse and because of the fact that I was gay and that she and the church had a problem with that. But because of multiple things that were said, studies that were thrown around, and then the final nail in the coffin of being told by the clinician that children that don't transition have a 40% likelihood of, in the words of the clinician, successfully committing suicide, not attempting suicide, successfully committing suicide. When my mom heard that, she was like, I have no choice. Like, this is how I have to keep my child alive. So Everything that happened after that was, okay, this is going to help keep my child alive.
Better a live son than a dead daughter, as the trans slogan goes. So is there any basis to the 40% claim? Do you know where that comes from?
I'm not terribly well versed in the literature regarding transition and pediatric transition. I believe, from what I've heard, I think it's like 40 to 41% attempted suicide, or maybe it's suicidal ideation. I don't know. I know for a fact, though, it is not successful suicide. So I know that was misquoted.
I think it also has something to do with, again, the cohort that you're talking about. If you're talking about people who have persistently and insistently from a very young age been the wrong gender and they are comprehensively thwarted throughout their lives, then that would be a different result than if you are including in your kind of sample group anyone who had ever requested or suggested, proposed the idea of transitioning. Nonetheless, let's park that for a moment. So you have the double mastectomy and your voice is where you want it to be, and you've got some of these other physiological changes like your muscle growth and so on. And at what point do you start to question all this?
It's interesting because I've been trying to figure out when the questioning began. I think it really began full force in 2022. Or like late 2021, early 2022.
And sorry, how long is that after you got the mastectomy?
Let's see. I got it in June 2018. So let's say June 2022. So about 4 years afterwards.
So you live a few years as a dude in a reasonably happy situation? I mean, what is your mental state over the period of time when you're
relatively speaking? It was, I had my ups and downs. I was never suicidal to the extent of needing to be hospitalized again. I dealt with bouts of severe depression. I was admitted into an outpatient eating disorder program in late 2019, and kind of dealt with that for a few years. But my mental health was generally better. I was pretty happy in how I was presenting, and at least I could put on a good show because, you know, I finally get to shop in the men's section, which I was never allowed to do because I was a girl, despite the fact that the clothes just fit better off the rack because I had broader shoulders. You know, I got to wear what I wanted. I got to actually cut my hair like I wanted to, but I wasn't allowed to because, well, that's for boys. You know, I got to do the things that I wanted to do, and I didn't have to lie about liking men. I could openly like women, and it would be okay. So that part of it was really cool. And my mental health, in spite of those ups and downs and those spikes, was generally better. Because I thought I had finally found the fix that, you know, this entire time, all of my problems, you know, besides the childhood abuse and the eating disorder and the depression and stuff, all of my other problems are caused because I was meant to be a man. I was meant to be male. And now I'm, you know, living my true authentic self and my true authentic life. And, you know, this is it. This is the fix. I can actually be my true self.
So, okay, so fast forward to last year, what starts changing?
I think part of it was having to reckon with my declining health. So kind of before I was in nursing school, I was a little bit of a meathead. I didn't have like super impressive numbers. I was into powerlifting and stuff, but like at one point I could deadlift well over 400 pounds, which is pretty good for a biological female. And from that point up until like when I had to drop out of nursing school, I went from deadlifting over 400 to not being able to lift 40 pounds at work, you know, working in a grocery store. And I went from being able to run a 5K to not being able to even go into a grocery store for 5 minutes. Went from being able to get straight A's and stay awake in class near photographic memory to almost flunking out of nursing school because I can barely stay awake in class, not being able, barely making it through clinical, nearly making med errors, and just generally feeling awful, and confronting this thinking, God, is this my new reality? And when you're thinking about your body and the changes that you've made to your body and all that stuff, it kind of starts to trigger some memories. And I was thinking about a lot of things about my life and my life decisions. And I don't know how or why that triggered the idea of transition regret, but that's when it started for me, was really starting to confront, like, gosh, has my life changed? Am I now, you know, for lack of better terms, somewhat disabled because of this?
And did that lead to another rabbit hole of internet searches and yet more videos from the other side?
Ironically enough, no, not for a few months. It led to some internet searches, but that was more so me trying to figure out what the hell was going on with me, because I had gone to all these specialists and nobody could figure out what was going on, or they just told me, oh, you're just stressed, or oh, you just need to work out more. They wouldn't run tests, or they would run blood tests and they were all coming back normal. And they were just like, oh, sorry, we can't help you. And so, you know, I investigated chronic illness stuff, but I didn't really start looking at the trans stuff until probably September. And that was when I was following some people on Instagram, primarily Buck Angel, who was affiliated with Gays Against Groomers, and talking about, I think he shared something about Chloe Cole and Standards of Care 8 and how that was just released. And I remember reading it and thinking, this is completely crazy. Standards of care have gone out the window, kind of pushing away my own questioning, and then reading Chloe Cole's story and then reading other detransitioner's story and thinking it was like the worst thing in the world, and also weirdly resonating with it, but not willing to recognize it yet. And that's when I started to investigate detransition more so from a place of trying to understand a quote unquote different point of view. But still thinking, oh, I'm trans, I transitioned, it was the right thing, I didn't regret this, but we need to understand people who did so we can keep it from happening again.
Right. And do you think in hindsight that maybe that was a way of, I don't know, extracting yourself from your own predicament, making it theoretical, making it intellectual, so that you didn't have to confront what had happened to you?
Oh, absolutely. This realization, coming to the realization that you've made this big of a mistake and that people around you have kind of advocated for you to make this big of a mistake and that you've done this thing for several years and now you are taking a step back and realizing it was just the wrong decision, it's a really painful come down. I don't wish this on anybody. So I can't fault myself or anybody for starting out kind of looking at this being like, well, I'm intrigued, I want to understand more, I deep down resonate with this, but I'm not willing to acknowledge it yet. Let's delve into this issue, but I'm still supportive of my camp. I still think I made a right decision.
Right. When did that shift?
So ironically enough, when I posted the video that went viral in October, I was still somewhat trans identifying, or at the very least, I was kind of regretting the transition, but I thought that there was really no way out, that, you know, I had done it when I was 16, I was 21, I thought that I looked too male to ever be taken seriously as a woman again. And that my preferences were, it sounds awfully misogynistic, but that the fact that I liked wearing men's clothes and all that stuff meant that I should just stay male. Or stay presenting as male, and that was just my fate. This is what I've done to myself. I've just got to suck it up and deal with it. And it was only after getting in contact with detransitioners who were all checking in on me after just the onslaught of attention that that video got and that I got, in talking and realizing that, you know, there kind of was a way out, or that at the very least I could try coming off of hormones. I could, you know, go to therapy and work on myself, that nothing was definite, that I could explore these issues further, that I started to consider detransition.
What was the reaction to the video that you made?
Oh my gosh. I think it hit conservative Twitter first. And somehow it pushed all the right buttons. I remember I was talking with another interviewer and podcaster, Benjamin Boyce, about it. He said it was unintentional on my part, but it was like perfectly crafted to elicit a very big response, you know, both from the left and the right. So I had a lot of conservative Twitter. They were sharing it around, and it was like, you know, oh my gosh, this poor young woman, look at what they did to her, you know, look at what testosterone did to her, and so on. And some of them kind of fell into like the fear mongering camp of, oh, they're doing this to our little girls, and, you know, look, you know, we need to hold these monsters accountable. Mm. And, you know, some of the detransitioners kind of rallying behind and saying, yeah, this kid was 16 when they went in for treatment, and, you know, now they're kind of facing this, and talking candidly about, you know, these perfectly safe and non-regrettable procedures that, you know, they have permanent lasting effects. And that was another thing too. People say, oh, testosterone is partially reversible. It partially is, but most of the effects aren't. And that was part of what the video was speaking on, is that the majority of these changes that have happened to me are not going to bounce back just because I stopped testosterone. And I can confirm, being 4 months off of testosterone, that virtually nothing has changed. Yeah. Like some body fat redistribution, but everything else is the same. And then the left side of Twitter, or the trans rights side of Twitter, just completely cut into my appearance. They called me ugly. They called me bald. They called me an idiot and stupid for quote unquote deciding to screw up my life. Like, oh, it's your fault for making this decision. Did you not look up what testosterone does? They thought that I didn't know what testosterone did because I was talking about one of the symptoms of testosterone use for me was a pretty noticeable male pattern baldness, which I, because of PCOS, I did have a male pattern hairline prior to starting testosterone, but it was not nearly this bad. And I can guarantee you, if I hadn't been on testosterone for over 4 years, my hairline would not be nearly as receded as it is now. Mm. So people are accusing me of misinformation. I got called a Hitler, genocidal Nazi, told to kill myself multiple times, got multiple death threats. It was quite the ride.
Extraordinary. Did you have any conflictedness about becoming a poster child for the conservative side of things? I mean, I know that you went on Tucker Carlson, and, you know, your video was featured in videos by Matt Walsh and people who dedicate their entire lives to essentially, I mean, they think that they're protecting children, but there is also something of a mass panic or a mass hysteria around this that is unhelpful to people who are happily trans and just want to get on with their lives. Have you been worried about sort of being played or becoming a pawn in people's culture wars?
I have been concerned about that since I saw Matt Walsh repost the video. And everybody, the other thing that was really crazy was that there was this conspiracy theory. There are multiple conspiracy theories. One conspiracy, the main theory is that this was all staged, that I planned this video. It was a scripted video that I planned, and that because of who I followed, as they say, alt-right accounts intentionally. So that they could find the video and signal boost it, and so I could cause mass hysteria, and that some people even went as far to saying that I wasn't trans, and not like in the sense of, oh, you transitioned but you were never actually trans. No, people were going around spreading rumors that I was in fact a biological man that is being paid by a company associated with Gays Against Groomers to make this video. So it was that whole crazy conspiracy theory, but I frankly was kind of horrified with how fast a lot of these very conservative YouTubers and media outlets were picking this up, and what they were saying, And especially I honestly was pretty scared when my clip ended up on Tucker Carlson. I didn't find out until a couple days after when I started getting messages on Twitter and they're like, hey, you're the person I saw on Tucker. And I'm like, you saw me where? Excuse me.
Oh, I see. I thought that you'd been on Tucker. He just played your clip.
No, they played my clip and they also got the facts wrong. They said, this is what happens when you give puberty blockers to a 15-year-old. And I'm like, you know, if you're going to air the clip, could you at least check my feed before you like, no, it wasn't 15. It was never on puberty blockers. Get your facts right.
Oh, I see. You didn't take puberty blockers, but you did take testosterone when you were 16.
I had just turned 17, like a month, before starting testosterone.
Right. Okay. And then on the other side, as you said, I mean, I saw when your clip initially passed through my feed was a tremendous amount of hate from the cohort that's closer to me than conservatives, which are progressives. I guess feeling offended that you were pointing to something that they think doesn't happen, or that their literature claims doesn't happen, and abusing you and pillorying you for, I don't know, exaggerating your plight, or like, oh, boo-hoo-hoo. Like, it's almost like your story is the price that we have to pay on the path to our glorious future of trans acceptance. And so your story is not valid somehow, or is fabricated somehow.
It's interesting because I think it was a friend of mine, Michelle, who is also a detransitioner from Canada. She put it this way, that she said, transition-related healthcare has turned from healthcare into a service, that patient, and, you know, you're no longer a patient, you are a customer and you're buying a service. And so if you're buying a service from somebody, the only person that you can blame at the end of the day, if that service fails, is the customer. The way that she put it, it was pretty interesting. Or another friend of mine who said transition cannot fail, it can only be failed. So I saw that attitude just play out.
It's your fault. Over and over again. It's your fault. The sexual abuse was your fault. Your chronic illnesses were your fault. Moving to Pennsylvania was your fault. Your mental health issues were your fault. Failing your transition was your fault.
Yeah, and it was really interesting. It was especially jarring to see YouTubers, particularly one, Ty Turner, and there were a couple others too, that I had grown up watching, female-to-male YouTubers, people who make their entire living, all of their content is based on them being trans and trans acceptance and talking about transition. And some of those people, specifically Ty Turner, his videos were some of, you know, the videos that made me think that transitioning would be the right move for me, like the one you're on testosterone and watching all of the updates and, you know, watching him kind of grow into his own. And then to just see him, like, see my video and blatantly just call me out and, you know, say, well, it's not my fault that you made a wrong decision. Stay mad, bald. That was basically what he said. Well, I remember he said, stay mad, bald, and then proceeded to upset some of his followers who were like, well, I'm MTF and I struggle with hair loss. How does that impact me? Or other FTM followers that were like, well, I kind of struggle with hair loss too. And then he proceeded to backtrack and was like, well, bald is hot, but I never said bald was bad. It's okay. But seeing, you know, these people that I had looked up to, these people that I had followed just turn on me. And it was kind of jarring.
Did that do a number on your mental health?
The entire thing. I would like to say that I coped relatively well in the beginning, and I had talked to people and they were like, well, you're doing a hell of a lot better than I would do, and approaching this with a lot more grace and gravitas than I would. But in all truth, I was dissociating throughout the entire thing. And the first few weeks was fine, but I wasn't really letting myself feel the emotions of both, you know, like the online harassment, because it was multi-platform. I was just on Twitter, but people were talking about me on Twitter. They were talking about me on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. They were talking about me everywhere. And I was receiving, I was queued up that there was a couple people sending me death threats, or not sending me death threats, but they were threatening me with death. Like on TikTok, there was a woman that threatened to bash my head in with a hammer on what's it called, Twitter. That was a fun one. And then she threatened Buck Angel because he called her out about it. And then she changed the prompt to basically say that she was going to bash Buck Angel's head in with a hammer. I think she's been reported. I hope she's having a better time. Sorry, that was a little tangent.
That's okay. It's just unbelievable what comes out of the world on social.
Yeah, but I guess the point I was trying to make was I had compartmentalized all of that. And so I think I just reached a certain point of fatigue and I felt the feelings. And that was when I really confronted, you know, like, okay, I'm a transition regretter. I did this, but like really emotionally, like actually feeling that and confronting the fact that I transitioned because of abuse and I transitioned because I wanted to trans the gay away. And that was kind of when the walls came crumbling down for me. And that was when I sought intensive outpatient, because I was just like, I'm crumbling. I'm falling apart because of this realization and because of everything that's happening right now.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that term before. I wanted to trans the gay away. Mm-hmm. Because we've heard the term, I want to, you know, you can pray the gay away if you're religious, just pray hard enough and you won't feel gay anymore. But to trans the gay away is, I guess, another illusion that people can go for. If they don't want to be gay, they can opt for this alternative, which in your case hasn't worked. So you stopped taking testosterone. You're now getting the mental health support you need. Is there anything else you can or are looking at doing, or are you in a state of like, I'm gonna find a way to love myself as I am?
So I've also gotten laser hair removal on my face. Part of that is also because of the EDS. My skin is really stretchy, and I've also just always had issues with the facial hair growth. I haven't had too much, but it's definitely noticeable. But I could never really get like a shave. Like, I could never shave without some sort of irritation. I could never shave without cutting my skin. I would always get ingrown hairs that would get inflamed. Also, because of the testosterone use, once I hit full dose, I had really severe cystic acne. Like, my face was swollen, there was pustules. I went to a dermatologist, I was on oral antibiotics, topical antibiotics, tretinoin. They threw a bunch of stuff at it and it just wasn't making a dent. And it eventually subsided with time, but like with the history of acne and plus being on the testosterone and just, you know, all the facial hair, like the way that the hair was growing in, it was just really irritating and hard to manage. So I figured that was probably one of the least invasive changes I could make. And not having a 5 o'clock shadow would maybe help a little bit and people somewhat believing that I was a woman. So I did that. And I mean, that's just kind of more of a personal thing in terms of it's just nice to not have to shave as much. And my face doesn't hurt now because facial hair is growing in. Because yeah. For me, it was painful. It was painful when it grew.
Right.
Otherwise, I am not really doing much of anything. I'm taking things slow. Kind of just seeing where I'm going to be. I don't think I'm going to seek any reconstructive surgery personally, because I don't see a point. I don't feel like that's something that I need to do psychologically.
And what do you think of your sex as being, or your gender as being, if they're the same?
Well, it's interesting because I don't feel like a woman, but in talking to people, they're like, yeah, well, there's no like inherent feeling of being a woman. You just are. But if we're going based off of stereotypes of how people behave and how they dress, I still fit the male stereotypes, but I'm much more comfortable with saying that I am a woman and I am female. But I happen to look very masculine. I'm a very masculinized woman. I'm much more okay with saying that. What pronouns do you use? Well, right now I'm still currently socially presenting as male, and all of my records say male. Everything's changed over birth certificate, social security, in articles and stuff. And there's certain people in like the gender critical circles that, regardless of what pronouns you ask them to use, they're just going to use whatever. I'm fine with people using she. That
for people who aren't quite inside the bubble enough to know what gender critical is and so on, I even find the terms a bit confusing. You're saying that there are anti-trans, let's just call them what they are, there are anti-trans people who just refuse to believe that anyone can be trans and therefore will always use the sex that was assigned at birth as being the sex. So even if you're a fully masculine presenting trans man like Buck Angel is, these people will just insist on calling you she. That's what you're about. So to them, you're always she. But I mean, we're not those people, and those people aren't the majority of people. So are you? Have you ever played with they, them? Does that make any sense to you?
I did originally when I was like considering the whole transition thing. And certainly if I'm talking about myself in the third person, I generally avoid using pronouns, or I use like neutral language. So like I was writing something and I'm like, hey, does anybody remember that kid that went viral in October for posting a video about the effects of testosterone? Yeah, that was me. But instead of saying like, you know, woman or anything like that, or trans guy, I kind of just try and stay the middle lane.
Yeah.
I'm still navigating that. Personally.
I'm also interested in what do you take away from all this in terms of your insight from your personal experience about the whole roiling culture war around this? Because it's interesting that earlier in this conversation you were saying that in your religious upbringing they taught you, you know, in your youth church would say that homosexuality is just a fad and it'll pass in religious youth group. You now hear people saying that transgender ideology is a fad. It'll pass. They use people like you and stories like you as pawns to try to push that narrative and to try to undermine the experiences of people who have had a persistent transgender experience since the, you know, as early as they can remember. Clearly, homosexuality is not a fad. It doesn't pass. It seems to be a reasonably fixed thing in most people's lives. There's a bit of blurriness at the edges. We're all a little bit gay. We're probably all a little bit bi, but you know, people tend to find their lane and then stay in it. Do you think that gender is more like that, or is it more fluid? Do you feel uncomfortable like thinking about transgenderism as potentially a fad that will pass? How do you reconcile them?
It's hard because I'm still trying to figure that out. There was a period of time where, admittedly, I was pretty radicalized. I, you know, thought that all people that transitioned were... Let me clarify what I'm about to say. I do not hold these beliefs anymore. This was just me trying to process and also being surrounded by a bunch of very right-wing people. I thought all trans people were delusional, that it was, you know, a fool's errand, that transition was useless, that it was just big pharma trying to take your money. And while I do agree that there can be a financial incentive for specifically like plastic surgeons, you know, trying to get people to get transgender surgeries, I maintain the belief that I had previously that there definitely are some people with very persistent gender dysphoria that probably will benefit from a medical transition and living as the opposite sex, or, you know, living in a different way than their birth sex, because psychologically that is going to be more beneficial than trying to live as their birth sex. But I also would like to assert that a lot of the newer generation, such as myself, and even some of the young adults in the informed consent model that are just, you know, walking into Planned Parenthood and getting hormones and all of that stuff, that the lack of psychological evaluation or proper psychological evaluation is not ruling out any possible other issues. So I think you can hate your birth sex for different reasons than being transgender. And we're just assuming there's a cohort of people that are assuming that if you hate your birth sex, that means you're trans. It doesn't matter, like, you know, that's just it. You were meant to be the opposite sex. No questions asked. Can't question it. You're transphobe. Here's your hormones. I don't think that's true. I think we need to take a balanced and nuanced approach to it. I don't think everybody that is seeking medical transition right now probably should be, but I don't think that it should just be off the table either. I think there are certainly people that still benefit from it. But if you're in my situation, or similar situations to me, there's definitely some other issues that just weren't being looked at that, you know, in some of these cases, we need to slow down and look at the surrounding issues and not just assume that you hate your birth sex because you're trans.
Casey, good luck to you. Thank you for hitting me up. It's amazing to hear your story, and I really wish you all the best. You've been dealt so many bad hands in your youth that I'm glad that it sounds like you've kind of found your lane and found your thing. So all our love from me and my my listeners, and please keep me posted and let me know how you're going.
All right, thank you very much for having me, Josh.